Yeah, I'd like to just highlight my collaborators, Mark Casals, Sam Gala, and Aaron Zimmerman. Without them, I don't think this work would have really been possible. So just a shout out to those guys. And we have papers on this. Feel free to check them out. One is brand new of yesterday, and the other one has been up for about a couple of months now. So the motivation for this comes from a result in 2010 stating that extremal black holes are linearly unstable. And this was quite a surprise because there is a lot of stability results for non-extremal black holes, and there was a mode stability proof for values of spin up to the extremal limit. And this was a bit of a shock. But the proof, although very general and applicable to many kinds of extremal black holes, those which have some type of adapted coordinates near the Killing horizon, it was limited in several ways. In particular, it restricted to just axisymmetric perturbations. So this is not a generic type of perturbation. It would be something like a very specific perturbation on the axis of symmetry, for instance, whereas astrophysically one would expect much more non-symmetric perturbations of the space-time. It involved conserved quantities existing only on the horizon, and these conserved quantities were only shown to exist through axisymmetry assumptions. And it's not really clear physically whether these conserved quantities are related to asymptotic symmetries. They're more like Newman-Penrose constants in some sense, and they're a little mysterious. And I think probably the most limiting thing is that it only applies precisely to extremal black holes. So in the phase space of black hole solutions, this is really just a set of measure zero. And although interesting, it's not really astrophysically interesting. And since his discovery, despite a whole lot of work on both the mathematical side and the physics side, the research has largely been within his initial restrictions, modulo some nonlinear results by Murata, Ta-Nehisi, and Rial, and some small perturbations around extremality within those numerical results.
What about polar perturbations?
Polar?
Yeah.
So I'll talk about that. Yeah, we're going to do that. So in our work, we really correct and improve all three of these things. So we recover the Eratosthenes instability in a mode expansion, which includes all modes, axisymmetric and non-axisymmetric, as a branch point at the superradiant bound. I'll talk a little more about what I mean by that. We extend it to non-axisymmetric perturbations, and we reveal that components of the Weyl tensor actually grow at the horizon and near it. And we connect.
Is that only for the non-axisymmetric space?
Yeah. And we connect to the long-lived quasi-normal modes of near-extremal Kerr, and we show that they exhibit a transient period of instability where they grow, and this transient period limits to Eratosthenes in the extremal limit. So I'm going to talk about all three of these. Before I get started on the results, I just want to give some background. I'm sure most of you know what Kerr black holes are, but just so we're all on the same page, the Kerr solution is a unique stationary vacuum solution, has two parameters, mass and spin. It has Killing vectors in the T and phi. Here we're using V, which is the Eddington-Finkelstein coordinate, which is regular on the horizon. The linear combination of these shown here generates the horizon, so this is ruling the horizon. It's type D, so it has shear free null congruence, and a byproduct of the type D-ness is that the radiative perturbations are encoded in a single scalar. So you can solve a wave equation for a single scalar and get all of the radiative information. This was shown by Wald in the 70s. So aside from.
Type D, is that particular coordinate system, or what is type D?
type D is a algebraic speciality of the spacetime. So if you look at the principal null vectors
of Kerr spacetime.
Of Kerr, yeah. A little bit about extremal black holes. So I'm going to talk about extremal black holes and near extremal black holes. So extremal black holes are those for which the parameters are saturated. So in Kerr, the mass is equal to the spin. In, say, Reisner-Nordström, it would be the charge equal to the mass. They sit at a critical point, which it's a separatrix between naked singularities in solution space and regular black holes. So as with most critical phenomena, one might think that there should be some scale invariance or some enhanced of symmetries at this point in the solution space. And indeed, the near horizon geometry of extremal black holes does enjoy an enhanced symmetry. So there's a particular scale invariance contained in this part of the symmetry group. The horizon generators are affinely parameterized. So the surface gravity is zero. And this is important because outgoing photons on the horizon, as measured by infalling observers, don't decay. So this would be the redshift effect typically associated with a measurement of a photon on the horizon. And this is going to one.
I think you meant that the killing coordinate is an affine parameter on the generators, because you can always parameterize them affine.
Sure, yes. Yeah. Yeah. And so the wave analog of this is typically used by mathematicians to control transverse derivatives. And if this parameter is degenerating, doesn't control derivatives in integrated energy estimates on the horizon. And this fact, combined with the conserved quantities that Eratakis identified, led to the proof of growth of transverse derivatives. So the limit to extremality is not unique, though. One can take the limit to extremality by fixing various coordinates. One could, say, fix Boyer-Lindquist far horizon coordinates and take A to M. And then one finds extremal Kerr with asymptotic flatness and blah, blah, blah. But they're physically interesting things near the horizon get smushed all at R equals M. One could take an alternative limit where you let A go to M by fixing scale coordinates, which are more adapted to the throat region. And there one recovers a neck spacetime with completely different asymptotics and enhanced symmetries. And these two limits are singularly related in the limit of zero surface gravity, but they give smooth metrics in each region. So this is just something to keep in mind as I talk, that the limit to extremality is not unique, and it will come up later.
Is it true? Space-time is only one. You're just choosing some particular regions of it where you focus one way or another when you take this. Or is this a matter of semantics?
No, there is real physics in the near horizon region. Like,
sure.
You have the IBCO and the ISCO, and all of those places get smushed onto the horizon in the far horizon limit. And the orbits, the dwellers there, get boosted to infinite coordinate velocities in the far horizon limit. So one really needs to consider both limits to resolve the physics in the different zones.
Right, but that's an operational approach that you use to, when you see the limit of the space-time, to analyze what's going on.
But there is physics there, too.
I'm not saying that.
Okay.
I'm not saying there is. I'm just saying that the way it's, well, the limit is going to be different if I take this or that. No, the limit is one. But the way I'm going to interpret what's going on near the horizon.
Yeah, all I'm saying is that it's not unique. You can fix different coordinates to take the limit.
Yeah, but I'm okay. So it might be semantics, but to me that bugs me a little bit because the space time is space time, and the coordinates are okay. I'm free to choose any coordinate I want.
Sure.
And so why would they have to think of particular coordinates?
I guess maybe the point is that there are different types of observables they might be interested in.
Right, but the space time is the space time. So. I mean,
but the space-time is the space-time, and it contains this region.
Sure.
of a large throw and to resolve the physics in that region. It's useful to use coordinates adapted.
The limit of the space-time, and then you say, I'm going to study what happens near the horizon, and therefore I'm going to choose these observers, and this is what this gets me see.
Yeah, and those observers near the horizon are at infinite boost relative to those.
So is there a coordinate transformation from net to material curve?
Yeah.
This is the singular one.
Yeah, it's a singular one. Okay, I want to move on. So we study perturbations of Kerr via the Tucholsky-Masker equation. So our variable of interest is this field variable omega s. It's defined in a tetrad which is regular on the horizon. So one could think of this as Hartle-Hawking. It's like Hartle-Hawking's tetrad. There's three sectors which we consider. We can consider gravitational perturbations. So these are spin plus or minus 2, corresponding to the field variables psi 4 and psi 0, which are just components of the Weyl tensor projected onto the tetrad. One thing to keep in mind is that psi 4 has two transverse derivatives to the horizon. So that'll be important later. We consider electromagnetic perturbations and also scalar perturbations as well. So the way in which we solve for psi is we construct a green function using a mode decomposition. So the Tucholsky equation separates, and one can project out the angular parts into a Sturm-Liouville problem. So these would be products of spheroidal eigenfunctions here. The radial content is contained in this, what we're calling a transfer function. So this is a two-point function between two radial coordinates decomposed into polar, azimuthal, and then continuous frequency modes. And we're going to reconstruct and resolve the time domain green function by taking a Laplace or inverse Laplace transform of these quantities. Transfer function, inverse Laplace transform. Before I get into our results, I just want to highlight some stability results of extremal Kerr that occurred before and then after Eratakis. So one kind of physical way to think about stability is you consider a background extremal Kerr spacetime and just evolve some wave packet or some small amplitude initial data, for instance, a scalar field, and just ask the question, does the solution grow large enough to excite nonlinearities and cause the perturbation theory to break down? Modus stability was established by Whiting, forbidding exponentially growing modes, but it doesn't prove boundedness and also decay of generic perturbations. So there's certain modes which do not exponentially grow, but could still result in some polynomial in time growth. So these were not ruled out by Whiting. And these modes, we shall show that these modes are related to the Eratakis instability. And Eratakis in particular showed axisymmetric perturbations do in fact decay, but the transverse derivatives, which are uncontrolled by the redshift, blow up polynomial in time. And this was extended by others to in gravitational case.
So what was the first result, though? You didn't say
mode stability was
small amplitude initial data. Like, what's the result?
The result would be, in the context of mode stability, that that data, the modes of that data would not.
So this is like a preamble for the rest.
Yeah, it's not negative. I was just trying to preface the stability.
You said though, like you consider a wave packet, you know, like a localized perturbation.
Yeah.
That, I guess you could build that out of modes.
Yeah, you could decompose it into its Fourier modes, yeah.
But then I have some trouble seeing how that's consistent with what you're going to tell us, but I think it's...
Yeah, the wave packet is important. That was just one particular set of initial data. I think I'm going to say, what I'm going to say is more generic, I hope, to convince you of that. So taking Whiting's mode stability results and also Eratakis's proof of growth, as a mode lover, kind of one gets a little nervous that somehow the mode analysis is deficient in some way. And a lot of people had thought that the mode, that Eratakis's instability would be invisible to a mode analysis. But we say no. We find that the derivative instability is just recovered as a branch point in the complex frequency plane, which was not covered by Whiting's mode stability proof. And furthermore, the technique, as I said, allows us to predict the growth of all modes, not just axisymmetric modes.
So what's the technical difference between Whiting's stability proof and
so
Whiting doesn't, what does he do that doesn't let him study?
So Whiting's proof maps exponentially growing solutions to an energy-like bilinear. And I think that map would reveal exponentially growing modes and rule them out. It did, in fact. But I don't think that the map covered modes existing on the real axis.
So you're counting a branch point as a mode?
Well, I'm counting it as a singular point in the transfer function.
Okay, it's not like a pole.
It's not a pole, it'd be a branch point. So the method we use, as I said, is a Laplace transform. And to give more kind of a physical or engineering picture of this operation is that it converts input or data, initial data, into output phi or field. And there are theorems from the theory of Laplace transforms that say that the very late time linear response of the field to the data is dictated by a singular point of the transfer function g in its complex frequency plane. We will take advantage of this. And the mode stability result is the lack of singular points in the upper half plane, but then linear stability would be all singular points in the lower half plane. So all modes exponentially decaying, at least at the level of mode decompositions in terms of complex frequencies. Of course, mathematicians would say need much more. The way we construct the transfer function is we match a set of homogeneous solutions in two regions, which we call the near zone, which would be like the neck region or near neck region close to the event horizon, and a far zone region where the radial coordinate is much, much greater than a quantity k, which is the deviation of the frequency from the superradiant bound. And we demand that the solutions are outgoing at infinity and ingoing at the horizon. And they have a common region of overlap because this k is always small. There is guaranteed a region where x is less than 1 but still greater than k. And we match the two solutions in this region. Now, we've only matched to leading order in K in currently published work, but we're also working on a series expansion which matches to all orders in K, and we've checked that we recover our results at the leading order. So the result of this matching is the following transfer function asymptotically near K equals 0 and close to the event horizon X equals 0. And we're going to look for singular points. So these are points which are non-regular in the complex plane, say at k equals 0. And what one finds is that at leading order away from the horizon, it's dictated by this parameter h. And then derivatives at the horizon, which is x equals 0, involve higher inverse powers of frequency, which make it more singular. And as I said, larger singularity in the frequency, in the complex frequency plane, generates larger growth, one could see that higher derivatives generate higher powers of growth. Now this quantity H, which enters at leading order, is very interesting, and it's related to the near horizon symmetry group, SL2R. So it's the so-called conformal weight, which labels representations of this group. And at the super radiant bound, the highest conformal weight solution is given by three different things, which split due to the fact that the conformal weight depends on the azimuthal and polar quantum numbers. So these have a physical interpretation as well. For the modes for which M is roughly greater than 3/4 L, these are in the geometric optics approximation. These are null geodesics, which are roughly equatorial. So they have small inclination angles. For these modes, which are subdominant, as we shall see, they're related to the null geodesics, which are at higher inclination angles. So we also call these polar in our most recent paper. And then there's axisymmetric modes, which don't really have a very intuitive relation to the null geodesics as far as I've thought of them.
So you have no
overtones here because we just have the branch point. So all of the overtones in the near extremal case have all collected. So to get to the results, the overtones would be the discrete set of modes, the quasi-normal modes.
Okay.
In the complex plane. So these would be the normal quasi-normal modes. That,
overtones are the same as quasi-normal modes.
Yeah, the overtones. The overtone number is just
more than one solution for a fixed element.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Sure.
So I'll get to that as well. For the equatorial modes or the dominant modes which have complex conformal weight, we find that the nth derivative of our field variable as V gets very large, grows like V to the number of derivatives plus the spin minus a half. And this tilde equal is asymptotic equality up to some bounded function. And the subdominant modes go as V to the number of derivatives plus the spin minus the conformal weight for real H values, which is always greater than one. So these modes here give, the complex ones give the dominant growth at late times. And we've arrived at these using theorems of Laplace transforms. So this could be made rigorous. For axisymmetric perturbations, things are a little bit more delicate analytically, so I'm only showing the spin 2 ones here. We find that the nth derivative of psi 4 has a quadratic decay for combinations of derivatives and quantum numbers here, and for all other combinations, it has this decay. And these are consistent with estimates previously given, and this jump was also predicted by Aratakis. So one can see that for L equals 2, both the zeroth derivative and the first derivative have inverse quadratic decay. And then the third derivative then jumps. So this is something that people had seen before. Although in many numerical papers, this particular case was omitted. So I don't know if they thought it was was wrong, or I'm not sure.
Next question about where, so is this all strictly outside the horizon?
No, these are all on the horizon, these growth rates. Yeah, these are precisely on the horizon. In the extremal limit, all of the instability is localized on the horizon.
Right. So, but do you have any information about the growth just inside the horizon versus the growth just outside?
The inside, I don't. The outside, I do.
So is the outside the same if I just like epsilon outside the horizon? It would be the same.
It's continuous in the near extremal case, so I'll show that. For the extremal case, I've only computed the decay in the buffer zone. So this is still small x, but x of order the super radiant bound deviation. But this could be made quite small if you take your frequency closer and closer to the branch point. So extrapolating from that, I think the decay that I find holds very, very close to the horizon as well. And I'll show those results.
So wait, just in a word, is it so if you're strictly away from the horizon, is there still growth of the kind that you're just showing us, or some?
Not in the extremal case. The extremal case, the transverse derivatives grow because the decay of the field jumps right as the horizon. So just off the horizon, the decay is stronger. So it's 1/1 time, for instance. And on the horizon, the decay is 1/1 square root of time. So as you jump just...
What?
Sorry?
Decay of what?
Decay of the field. Decay of the
scale. I thought you were telling us there were cases where there's no decay, there's growth of perturbation.
So for spin one and spin two, mm-hmm. So spin is like a derivative. As you go to spin two, you get derivatives of the metric and the vial curvature. So for no derivatives, that would be like the potential, like the metric or the gauge field or the scalar field. That is decaying.
Wait, so I'm just trying to ask, in looking at a quantity that does grow, whatever quantity you want, at late times, does any such quantity grow when you're strictly away from the horizon?
No, so not for the extremal case. All spins and all derivatives all decay.
And of course, they also decay in the non-extremal case.
They grow in a region in the non-extremal case, as I'll show, which is proportional to the surface gravity. So there's a transient ramp up of growth, and that transient period, or that transient, the spatial resolution of that transient period, is in a region proportional to the surface gravity, and as the surface gravity goes to zero, it all gets smashed up on the event horizon.
And it's only transient.
It's only transient.
There's no case of continued growth outside the horizon.
For unbounded, no. There's no unbounded. There's no unbounded growth off the horizon. Yes.
Yeah. I think I'll tell you and why this is all happening.
Okay. So as I said, axisymmetric perturbations have stronger decay. The non-axisymmetric modes yield the dominant growth. So infalling observers with regular far horizon limits, so for instance, the probes that Earth might send into the black hole will measure large energy densities in their respective frames and large tidal fields at the horizon. The decay off the horizon is also something that we computed. So for all values of spin and all derivatives off the horizon, we get inverse power law decay. And like I said, this is the leading decay independent of spin and number of derivatives. So an explanation for this growth, or one explanation, is that off the horizon, for instance, the scalar field or any of the potential fields will have a 1/1 V decay, but precisely on the horizon, that decay jumps to a 1/1 square root of V. And this jump in decay over a short spatial distance implies that the transverse derivatives must grow. And a simple example of this is just this exponential. It's decaying everywhere except for x equals 0. And at x equals 0, x derivatives will grow as power laws in V. And this is more generally applicable to any self-similar field, which also ties into the near horizon symmetries. Okay, now I'm going to shift and discuss our results for near extremal Kerr. So this is Kerr at small but finite surface gravities. So the spin is very close to the mass, but not exactly at the mass. And near horizon modes are obtained by, say, fixing some omega bar and taking sigma to zero, omega will go to the horizon frequency. So these are the modes of interest, the ones still near the horizon frequency. So mode stability was proven and strengthened more recently, but there's also linear stability results for all sub-extremal solutions, at least to scalar perturbations. So there's decay and boundedness for all perturbations. So we should respect that. Sort of fascinatingly, the near extremal Kerr spacetime, it's natural quasi-normal modes. It's like a cavity that's open, so it can support a set of modes which have decay but also resonate, localized around the horizon frequency. So it's like a set of oscillators all oscillating at the horizon frequency. So each overtone has a real frequency m over 2. One excites these, say, by some generic far zone initial data, and you get this collective excitation. And when you sum up all of these overtones, instead of getting an exponential decay, as one would expect, because each of these have a small imaginary part, one finds that the decay slows transiently from an exponential to a power law. So this was shown in the far zone by several people. And these modes, they vanish in the extremal limit, and they become the branch point that we studied previously. So we perform the overtone sum. This is work with Aaron and Sam for the equatorial or complex or dominant modes, however you want to call them, near the horizon and on the horizon. And we find that for suitable early times, that the rate of the field exactly matches the rate that we found for the extremal field. And then slightly off the horizon, we find subleading corrections. For
sigma
is the surface gravity. So sigma is 2 times square root 1 minus a squared over m squared. So as you go to extremality, sigma is getting small. So we're calling this, and I think this is really a transient instability, so it's a period of growth of linear perturbations that grows until a time equal to 1 over the surface gravity, and then decay sets in and becomes exponential.
By the way, there's a mistake on this slide. Surface gravity is kappa, not sigma.
I know, it has the wrong dimensions, but we're calling it, they're proportional. No, just notation?
Let's call it the mass. Long-standing tradition to call a surface gravity by the letter kappa.
Yeah, but then there's fours. I didn't want to. Okay, so we find amplification of the fields in a narrow window around the horizon for some period of time dictated by 1 over sigma. So what would observers measure? If you have a infalling observer that falls into this region near the horizon, he would or she would measure a large observed energy density in his frame or her frame that goes to infinity in the extremal limit and also goes precisely on the horizon in the extremal limit. for charged particles passing through this region, they would encounter large Lorentz forces, transverse Lorentz forces. There's a possibility, and I'd like to learn more about this, of nonlinear QED effects. If the spin is large enough, you might be able to get near the Schwinger bound, where you can produce pairs out of the vacuum. This is it might be ruled out by other things or undetectable, but it's certainly interesting to think about.
Well, one issue is how wide is the region where this is happening?
So yeah, as you go closer and closer to extremality, where the effect becomes more prolonged, the region is getting smaller and smaller.
And then, you know, if it's smaller than Compton wavelength of the electron.
Yeah, then you produce higher energy particles or something.
Well, but also when you need to extrapolate what would happen when things are growing, at some point you say, well, what would back reaction do?
Yeah, yeah.
Gravity? Yeah.
Yeah, so that's also something that we can't. Yeah.
But okay, so if this is similar to the other things that I have similar behavior, so is there only a special initial condition that could grow, to this maximum? So you could have, So like it's a question of choice of initial conditions. Do all of them grow? Because obviously, not every initial condition would do this.
Probably every generic initial condition.
Yeah. So.
But that's the question. Because you still have a mode analysis that says that every mode decays. Is that not true?
Every mode decays, but the decay rate or the decay time is very, very long.
Right, decay time, but every single mode decays.
Yeah.
If I just put a single mode there, that's where it decays, not correct.
Yeah, but
well,
the
except
thing
the decoration. Except the decoration.
Well,
a single mode has just one decay time.
Yeah, if you put in just a driving mode, it will decay. What we're showing is that the collective phenomena of exciting all of the modes.
And that depends on the amplitude that you assume for them also.
Yeah, it depends on the amplitude of the initial perturbation, but you could always find a family of solutions with the spin large enough to get this effect.
Okay, so that's the thing. So you have to a particular fine-tuned initial condition.
No, it's not fine-tuned.
You're saying it's not fine-tuned.
No. Now, generic initial data with the smooth far horizon limit will give rise to this effect. So the gravitational fields also get amplified. If I think about a continuous process which leaves the field saturated at their peak values, the amplitudes of those fields, the outgoing radiation field psi 4 will saturate at a value proportional to sigma to the minus 3/2. So this is related to the larger number of transverse derivatives in the near horizon region. And then psi 0 is suppressed because it's tangential. And this may contribute to a small enhancement of tidal fields, but this is most likely minor relative to just the background tides. So here's a plot showing a computation of psi 4 normalized by its value on the horizon, its maximum value on the horizon, as a function of scale time. And for different values of scaled position, so this would be on the horizon, this would be close to the horizon, and then all the way up to 10 m away from the horizon. For some value of sigma, I can't remember what Aaron used for this plot. But we can see that the observer measuring the field at the horizon finds the largest amplitude growth and it grows in the shortest period of time. And then as you go further away, the amplitude goes down, and then the time, the decay time, is shorter, so it decays so much faster.
The late time decay rate is consistent with the lowest possible amount that was excited?
Yeah. So just a summary of...
So what combination of... So what is the initial, I guess, mode that you assume? Do you have, because you have a combination of quasi normal mode. So what is it that you assume here?
The initial conditions here, we just put in something like a delta function pulse at the 2-2 frequency.
Delta function in time?
In radius on the initial slice, there was just some localized spike, and it had some harmonic content, I think 2-2, and we just evolved that. Yeah. And then extracted the values at the horizon. So the rule of thumb is that the potential fields for, say, a continuous source perturbing them sitting at the saturated value go as sigma to the half. The fields, or let's say the monopole forces, gradient phi, the field strength, and the Christoffel symbol, goes sigma to the minus 1/2, and then the curvatures have two derivatives, and they'll go as sigma to the minus 3/2 at a time where the maximum value is inverse sigma. So another way to think about this, so far I've been thinking about things in terms of far zone or far horizon regular initial data, and observers which have a smooth far horizon limit. But one could also think about other limits. So the limit I've been considering is fixing ingoing Kerr and taking the extremal limit. And this is faithful to far zone observers and the probes that they drop into the black hole. But physically interesting orbits near the black hole, near the horizon, get boosted infinitely in the extremal limit and also put on the horizon, so they become tangent to the generators in some sense. But one could take a different limit which is faithful to the near horizon observers and the planets they live on by fixing these scaled coordinates and taking sigma to zero. So this is faithful to, say, the Millerites in Interstellar, who sit on the ISCO.
What was Miller?
What?
The astronaut?
Miller was the name of the planet.
Oh, okay.
He never told us how
we got that name, right?
I don't think so, yeah.
Miller's planet, we have that skip.
But this transformation is singular related to the far horizon region in the sigma goes to zero limit. But they both have smooth metrics with respect to themselves. So what we're showing is that fields with smooth far horizon limits look singular to near horizon observers and vice versa. And that far zone adapted initial data, so this is data which is smooth in the far horizon limit, or fixing far coordinates and taking the extremal limit, generically excites these near horizon modes. So this is a field analog where the field gets spontaneously set up by these perturbations and causes chaos in the near horizon region. And it's similar to this BSW effect, where you can have particle collisions of large center of mass energies by just having a, you know, bombarding Miller's planet with a piece of dust or something from the far zone. And the derivative growth, at least the scaling of the derivative growth, could have been predicted just based on how the derivatives between the near zone or the near horizon and the far horizon scaling coordinates behave with respect to each other. So this effect can be thought of as kind of a near horizon, far horizon crosstalk, where data in one region excites the other region. And it can be written in a way in which the near horizon response, or the near horizon mode response, has a scaling in sigma times something that's scale free in sigma, and connecting points in the far zone with points in the near zone. And this is a self-similar scaling, which has been predicted by symmetry arguments again. So one could have gotten this just from knowing that spin S fields have S derivatives. These phases may have taken a bit of work, but the bulk scaling of this could have been gotten just by considering these limits, which is quite interesting. Another kind of related and very interesting thing we might be able to say something about is the turbulence phenomena that Luis and Juan and Aaron had worked on, where these integer space quasi-normal modes can excite parametrically nonlinearities which have a turbulent cascade-like behavior, which puts energy into different modes in a turbulent-like way. They estimated a Reynolds number by assuming that a driving perturbation was just this, the single overtone. So this is like the inertial component of the Reynolds number. But the coherent excitation of all of these modes will likely lower this Reynolds number. I guess this should be raised, the Reynolds number. Yeah. This should be, it will like, yeah, it will lower the criterion and generate higher. So they assumed that the inertial content, so the Reynolds number is roughly the inertial divided by the viscous, and the inertial is kind of dictated by the amplitude of the perturbation H, which the field resonates on, so the linearized driving mode. And for one mode, this is just going to scale as sigma, but this collective excitation extrapolating from psi 4, the potential will scale as sigma to the half, and it will lower the criterion for the Reynolds number and possibly, you know, take it to infinity in the extremal limit. So this is something we'd like to follow up on.
On this point, so you're trying to as you imagine an exterior observer preparing initial data, then you would go in, you would excite all these of these collective modes. Mm. But if you now lower the speed, that doesn't happen, right? So the amount by which you excite current modes, it diminishes with speed.
Yes, so now
would you argue that as you lower the speed, H is not for sigma, but once you go to sigma again?
Yeah, there might be some threshold where this is not valid anymore. But I think for sufficiently high spins, this will be. Yeah, I haven't done an exhaustive study of the parameter space. This is just, I mean, this really is kind of to be taken with a grain of salt anyway, because we're extrapolating from psi 4, and it's a bit of a pain to reconstruct the metric. So it's just an expectation at this point. But it's very interesting because now the Reynolds number has a scaling with sigma, which wasn't previously there. Okay, so there's a few open questions. Well, there's many open questions, but there's a few that are interesting to me that I'd like to follow up on. So one is, what happens when we consider initial data which penetrates the event horizon? So we've always looked at compact initial data that's far away. But all of the mathematical results in axisymmetry found enhanced growth rates for horizon-penetrating data. So we'd like to do that as well and see that in our mode expansion. I'd also like...
I'm sorry, all the which showed enhanced?
The cases where the initial data.
Is that numerical results?
No, also, So the Eratakis constants are conserved quantities from field values on the horizon. And these field values, if you have initial data on the, that intersects the horizon, they just take the form of that data. It'd be very interesting to look for non-axisymmetric conserved quantities on the horizon. And to see if maybe they're related to some kind of asymptotic symmetries, like something like BMS, possibly. The CFT analog of this instability is very interesting, certainly. There's conjectured to be a Kerr CFT correspondence. In the extremal limit, the CFT becomes chiral, so maybe some simplifications will occur there. And presumably, this instability should reveal itself in some way if the duality holds. And for non-extremal Kerr, there's a number of open questions as well. What happens non-linearly? So this is something that Stephen and I are thinking about, and also Luis. What solution do you settle down? How do the modes trade energy and angular momentum? Are there observational consequences of the transient phase? Do you, is there synchrotron radiation? Is there emission lines? And also possibly turbulence showing up in gravitational waveforms?
Why would you expect synchrotron?
Just because if you have a large magnetic field, I think the synchrotron radius will scale with the magnetic field, so maybe there's.
Can you get like a coherent magnetic field near the horizon that's very strong?
Well, I'm thinking that this amplification may have some coherent phase.
But earlier you mentioned QED vacuum effects.
Mm-hmm. This is different.
It's not on your list here.
Yeah, that should be on my
list.
Yeah.
This is not a good instability for non-extremal effects. You just have a limited growth for some period of time. So I mean, the best you could hope for is that you have stuff that are falling through the horizon, so they may grow a little bit, and then they're going to fall through the horizon, and then they're going to fall through. So, I mean.
Yeah, but say, in the environment around the black hole, there would be a constant source of perturbations.
If there's a continuous source, then it could sit at this value. Yeah. Be large. Stationarily large.
So are you suggesting that somehow then this could be unlimited growth if you keep throwing things? I mean, I don't see how it seems to be you throw something, it grows a little bit and then falls to the horizon.
Yeah, you could imagine pinging it at a continuous rate.
Yeah.
So that it sits stationarily. I mean, of course, nonlinearities might change the story, but that's something one could imagine doing, having a disk or.
Well, if you have a binary.
Or a binary, yeah, any continuous source.
Like a Brayton permit, you just continue to feed the energy to your roots now.
I think what you want to establish is that if you put a source, somehow you have a genuine instability, not just a transient growth. Because this is not an instability, this is just. I mean, if there's a continuous thing, everything that falls in grows a little bit and then goes through the horizon.
Well, it depends on what you're thinking by instability. This is what they say, is that there's a linearization instability problem. If you don't.
Not for extreme care, just there's a limited growth, not that.
That's fine. I mean, what I'm saying is that there is a regime below which, if you perturb, then you see a very just decay. The other one is saying that there's another regime where you actually see this collective growth, even though it's short time frame. I would call that an instability. You cannot use your simple-minded linearized picture to predict that, whatever you kick it with, it's just going to relax that way. So just you move the energy from some modes into another.
Well,
if you think of instability as something that completely makes the things flow up, but that's a difference.
Right. No, I mean, it seems to me, so what happened, I guess it sounds like a focusing, I would call it, because it just things are falling through the horizon, and as they're approaching the horizon, they grow. But then and they pass through the horizon and you don't.
But isn't it just that you might have a steady state, so it would saturate depending on the rate that stuff was coming in.
Yes.
And the time of the growth period, you could have a steady state with high intensity through the horizon.
Right, but that's a simpler, I mean, that's a different calculation. They just have to solve for accretion flow or something like that. So, but, so, and that's something that maybe you do it. I guess there are solutions like MHC accretion flows, right? There are, or MHC or force free accretion flows. So
this is just that, radiation, but for example,
it's just field.
So that's even simpler.
Just electromagnetic.
So, yeah. if you think there are steady state solutions, so they shouldn't be time dependent. They just solve for time independent solutions of maximum equation. And the question is, do you expect to see something non-trivial? I don't think so.
Well, I'm saying that you do.
No, but you haven't. No, but I mean, you're claiming something beyond what you have actually shown. I mean, what you've shown is a limited growth for some wave pattern.
No, I'm saying that there's a well-defined class of regular observers which see large energy densities, fields, and time.
They see limited growth. That's what they
see. Well, what would be really interesting, you showed us this box of what you get from putting in a pulse.
Uh-huh.
So you could just put in and integrate that pulse against some profile of the incoming stuff.
Yeah.
And then just see what you get. It won't decay. It'll be where it saturates and how that depends on the incoming
signal. Yeah.
Seems mm-hmm. like you could easily do it.
Yeah, certainly.
Okay,
thanks.
So do you want to know why this is happening?
Yeah, please.
So a long time ago, when people started studying deep brains as systems that exhibit entropy and Hawking radiation, I was trying to understand how that was consistent with the semi-classical picture of black hole. This is for extremal or near extremal black holes. So I thought, well, maybe what's going on is that there's a puzzle, because the information paradox seems to exist for black holes, but not for deep brains. Deep brains are just like complicated atoms. So their excitation and evaporation is unitary. So I thought maybe that once you turn on the gravitational coupling, there's actually an instability of extremal black holes. And that would be what breaks down the equivalence between the deep brain analysis and the black hole analysis. So I looked at charged extremal black holes, or near extremal,
mm-hmm.
to see whether there could be any reason why they would be unstable. And I found there was one, which is the following. So if you think about the horizon of a black hole, nothing can escape from it. But outside of it, things take a long time before they escape if they start very close to the horizon. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, inside the horizon, if it's a normal black hole, something that's trying to escape still falls in further. In other words, dr, d, d lambda, if lambda is a parameter along, say, the, so you have an outgoing null geodesic inside the horizon. It still falls further in, even though it's trying to go out.
Yeah.
But if it's an extremal black hole, or if it's an extreme black hole, first of all, that's not the case. It actually approaches the horizon from the inside.
Right, because there's no trapped surfaces, right?
Exactly. And moreover, if it's a non-extremal black hole, if you're inside the inner horizon, you also still go out. So in other words, outgoing null geodesics approach the inner horizon. When the two horizons merge in the extremal limit, that means that everything inside that's trying to go out is piling up on the horizon. So it's getting focused and contracted onto the horizon. And so that's a reason to have an instability. And I think that's precisely what's causing this instability, because any data is going to scatter a little bit over the curvature of geometry. Part of what it scatters into is the outgoing radiation inside the horizon. But that stuff piles up on the horizon and becomes singular in the exactly extremal limit. And in the New York City one, I mean, it just piles up for a while. Mm-hmm. You can draw a little picture of it, it's in my paper.
Couldn't you use these arguments in the near 3K? Suppose you do this calculation sufficiently accurate that if I can you use it to say, suppose I measure outside the horizon, just outside the horizon, something, and then not then be extracting information from the inside?
No, I mean, it's perfectly consistent with causality.
Right, but what you're saying is the rate at which, by seeing the rate at which it's growing, and you're saying that coming up an explanation or an argument based on something that's going on inside.
Well, that's why I was asking him, is any of the growth happening outside the horizon? The answer was no. It's all inside.
No, it's at the horizon and it's by the outside.
No.
Sure.
It's only exactly on the horizon in the extremal case.
It's only
on
the horizon.
In the near extremal case. In the near extremal case.
This is it.
It's here.
Yeah.
So
I go outside.
Yeah, so for
that's
small...
No, but that's a different phenomenon, I think. That I think, is just the fact that... that escape is... how can I put it? Things that are skimming along the horizon are not decaying exponentially with surface gravity, so you don't have much decay, so it builds up for a while. But I think it's a different phenomenon. We could talk about it in detail.
Cool. Yeah.
I think there might be a way to test my understanding, though, by looking at the near extremal and carefully resolving where the growth is biggest. That is it inside the inner horizon or inside the outer horizon?
But you don't have the ability to ask what's going on inside, though.
We haven't thought about it that much. Yeah, I think one could make a suitable adaptation to do it.
Perhaps so it looks rather bump, so it's by the outside the horizon, or it just keeps growing monotonically towards the horizon.
So Ted, were you thinking about this mass inflation instability of the inner horizon? Because your explanation was for that, isn't it?
Well, no, this is different from that.
No. I mean, let me now phrase it, turn it around and say yes. Pretend I didn't have any suggested reason. You gave us a beautiful talk with like really well-adapted mathematical tools to get surprising results, right? Why is this happening? I mean, there should be a simple intuition about why this thing should be unstable. Do you have any other suggestions?
Well, my intuition is the existence of the New Horizon region. It's the singular limit between the two geometries, and the fact that there's a crosstalk between the two appeals to the intuition of the growth, for me at least.
That didn't sound like a very intuitive.
Yeah, that's
my mind. You might have developed the intuition because you've worked with
the
math.
Yeah, because the sin has steeped me in the near horizon dogma, too.
here's a suggestion. So in the extrema limit, so the proper distance to the horizon blows up. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah.
Depends which path you approach the horizon on.
I'm thinking of a charge black hole now, but yeah. So is that...
But still, I mean, you know, if you go orthogonal to the Killing field, time translation Killing field, then it goes to infinity.
Okay, so that's something you should think about. But if the proper distance does go to infinity, so imagine you have a wave front, right? That's moving. Now, if you add a small perturbations on it, eventually it's going to cross itself and you're going to make cross waves. So I'm just wondering whether that could be, of course, if the perturbations are small, that's going to take a long time for this to happen. But if the distance that you're traveling basically becomes very long, then you're eventually going to perform cross waves.
I don't think that's relevant at all, because if you generate a perturbation outside the black hole, let's say, you can sort of picture on a space-time diagram where it falls in across the horizon.
Yep.
That's nowhere near the infinitely long growth region that you're thinking of. there's nothing large about the distance, I don't think, really, as far as something announced infalling perturbation is concerned.
Well, I mean, in the conformal diagram, of course, it's you cannot tell because everything is strong. But I agree with that for non-extremal black hole, but for extremal black hole, I don't know. You might have potential.
I think you can still tell. You can just draw the light cone of your initial perturbation location mm-hmm. and see where it cuts across the horizon, where it intersects the space-time. And it just doesn't go down along rabbit hole.
So I have another comment. So I don't know if you looked at that the papers I told you about the transient. So the same thing happens for fluids in accretion disks, that you get transient
yeah.
growth.
Yeah.
And it does, I scale, I was just thinking, it scales with some power of the Reynolds number, which it might actually be consistent with the power. What was the, how did it scale the power of sigma?
But hold on, that is that a linear, that is that a linearized calculation?
Yeah, it's a linearized calculation. It's the same
but
idea.
How do you even bring up a Reynolds number if you're doing a linearized calculation in fluid?
I mean, you have Reynolds number.
If you do a linearized calculation, you lose some. So the Reynolds number is when you ask.
But there's viscosity, right? So.
Yeah, but it's you have a nonlinear part, which is the BdV is giving you part of the Reynolds number. So if you do a linearized calculation, you lose the BdV.
Okay, so this is it. This comes from the background. So you have.
So you're assuming a particular configuration.
This is for a Keplerian accretion disk, but I mean, you could do it in other backgrounds. But so this is a question of looking at the stability of fluid in some background. Right? So the velocity comes from the background.
Yeah, but I think this intrinsically has nonlinear structure field.
Well, nonlinearity comes from the background. That's where you get.
Right, so he doesn't.
Well, I mean, here there's also a background,
yeah.
which is the black hole.
We have thought about this bypass like analogy where the collective excitation of the modes with the long decay times lowers the Reynolds number sufficiently that turbulence.
We have very similar curves to this. We have transient growth and then we eventually decay. Right?
Yeah, I think it's probably a general property of modes which.
So, can you remind me how it scales with sigma?
Psi 4?
Yeah.
You're saying this is in a situation of accretion on a black hole?
That, I mean, this is something generic, right? Anytime you have a fluid which is which has viscosity, which has viscosity. Now, if the viscosity is large enough, then all the modes would decay, right? But you could find combinations of the modes that grow. Around generic background. For an example is that you have a Keplerian accretion disk, and this is completely a current problem. All the modes always all decay, but you can find combinations of them that grow in the same way. And the maximum growth, I was looking it up, it grows as the 2/3 power of the Reynolds number. So, and then since you already have a candidate for the Reynolds number, you could actually compare those to each other.
Certainly.
Do you have a candidate for calculation?
Well, you were just showing something. You said Reynolds goes as something.
That was our calculation.
Okay, yeah, because he was quoting you.
So I took their Reynolds number and I just changed the amplitude of the inertial part, where the scaling of the inertial part was sigma.
But that calculation uses explicitly the nonlinear calculation.
Yeah. So yeah, I can't generate a Reynolds number from this work specifically. I can just borrow and make very vague statements.
Here you're trying to interpret distance to in terms of these branch points of the Coombs function.
Uh-huh.
But say the Coombs function of a security structure space, and also
Yeah.
So what's the difference then? There we have stability here, we have instability.
That's a good point. So the branch points can really go either way. They're responsible for our late time tails. But the existence of a branch point doesn't tell you whether it's power law decay or power law growth. Okay. So as it happens here, the branch point at omega equals zero still gives power law decay, just a standard price tail. But the emergence of the branch point at the horizon frequency from all these modes gives a growth. And until you did the calculation, until we did the calculation, we just weren't able to